So the reason I wanted to give a series on the Book of Maccabees was, quite frankly, because I wanted an opportunity to learn seriously the Book of Maccabees. And what became clear very quickly was that there's absolutely zero point learning the Book of Maccabees without actually understanding the history of the actual, not just Hanukkah story, but entire everything that surrounds it. Because the best way to appreciate the Book of Maccabees is to really be aware of what it's actually responding to, or what it's describing, what it's selectively describing. And so today we're not even actually going to look at the Book of Maccabees, and we're going to spend the entire time having almost a history class. I cannot tell you how much this is one of the most fascinating historical stories I have ever read. It's absolutely everything. Like, that it has not been dramatized yet is only because not enough people know it, because as you're going to like hear, it's just, it's incredible. It's full of plot twists. It's amazing. I read most of this history through the commentary of the Anchor Bible, who have a commentary to the Book of Maccabees. A friend had warned me that the author of the, he has like a 170, 80 page introduction, and my friend warned me he's very good, but very boring. And he's one of those people who he doesn't realize, in the middle of describing super crazy, awesome assassination, starts going off on tangents of how, you know, we can prove all of these various things took place, and it's like, get back to the assassination. So it was a bit of a painful process to collate this story into the story, and I'm going to tell you right now, and I'll mention it towards the end, at a certain point in this story, I'm just going to give up. And you can already see on the list, so again, the list is kind of, it's a cast of characters, because really, there's a lot of names, and you will see there's a lot of names that aren't familiar, and there's a lot of names, especially with the Seleucid kings, that are the same as other names. So this way, it's just, rather than trying to keep everything up in the air, you can at least see on the sheet, you know, basically the main people I'm going to talk about. There's obviously a lot more people that are relevant to the story, but these are the main ones. I think, yeah, there are 7 Seleucid kings, which already gives you a sense of the expansiveness of this story. In truth, at 7, when it got up to like the 8th king usurping the throne from another one, I was like, okay, this is it. But again, a lot of this stuff is very, very relevant to understanding the Book of Maccabees. And in truth, the Book of Maccabees, while not part of the canon, while not part of Tanakh for a variety of reasons, doesn't do a lot of things so differently to Tanakh. If you think of, you know, what Tanakh often does, ultimately, is it interprets historical events through a religious lens, whether that's Pesach, where we obviously have kind of, you know, the Exodus being interpreted as fundamentally a religious experience from which we learn religious messages, through the Nevi'im, who also, if you think of the prophets, they are taking historical events that are happening to the kingdom of Israel, and they are interpreting them through a religious lens. And in truth, even if you think of nowadays, kind of how the religious community reacts to a thing like Yom Ha'atzma'ut, it's not just a secular holiday celebrating the founding of Israel, but is seen as, in some way or another, an event worthy of religious celebration. And so the Book of Maccabees takes this historical story and reads it through. There are actually 2 books of Maccabees we're going to be looking at. Next week we'll look at the first. The second week we'll look at the second. One responds to the other. Both of which are taking these historical events and reading them through certain lenses. But before that, we actually need to know the story. The truth is, I don't know how many people, I think if you poll most Jews, the truth is, no one knows anything about the Hanukkah story. At best, people know there is a Greek king, Antiochus, it's Antiochus, that's the actual name, but when you translate that into Hebrew, you get Antiochus. I'm going to call him Antiochus, even though that makes me sound like one of those people who's insisting on always being correct about things, but that was his name, it was Antiochus. I'm going to try and use Hebrew names for Jews and the Greek names for Greeks. But basically, we have this king Antiochus who persecuted Jews for some unknown reason, and the Jews kind of rebelled, and happy things happened because of that, but in truth, that is not a very good description of the story. And I've spoken about before some of these things. If you look at, say, the tension between Al-Hanisim, which seems to commemorate a military battle, and in contrast, what we actually celebrate on Hanukkah, which is a miracle of oil, which we probably won't touch on until really the final week. But the truth is, there's just a lot of stuff we just don't know about the Hanukkah story. And kind of tonight, we can kind of split it up into all the things that lead up to the story of Hanukkah, Greek king persecuting Jews. That actual story in and of itself is kind of the least almost interesting part. And then all the stuff that happens afterwards, because in some ways the craziest stuff happens after the Hanukkah story. But the biggest single mistake we make with the Hanukkah story is thinking that it's about Greeks. There are no Greeks. That's not true. There are Greeks kind of at the beginning of this story. Calling the Seleucids, who are the bad guys of the Hanukkah story, Greeks is like calling Americans English, because they speak the same language, they have a shared culture, but basically the Seleucids are not Greek. They speak Greek, and there are definitely certain elements of Greek culture that they have, but they are, their capital Antioch is like modern day southern Turkey on the border of Syria, so they are very much a Middle Eastern people. Like, they are very much, you know, as much as the Jews of this time are Middle Eastern people, so too are the Seleucids. So when they are sometimes referred to as Greeks, they're not Greek. In fact, kind of all of this begins with their attempts to conquer Greece. And really that begins the process by which the Hanukkah story starts. And so to really appreciate what happens, just very quickly before we actually get into the history of the Hanukkah story, the Seleucid Empire. So the Seleucid Empire, it will come as no surprise, was first king was called Seleucus. Seleucus, who knows? He was a general for Alexander the Great, and after Alexander the Great dies, you know, parts of the kingdom are split up into various pieces, and Seleucus takes control of vast areas of the kingdom begins his reign in 305 BCE. The kingdom, the empire isn't particularly successful until the first person on the sheet, who is Antiochus III, who is the great-great-grandson of Seleucus I, and he makes tremendous military gains. And he begins his reign in 222 BCE. Just kind of, I already think I mentioned this, but basically every single king, at least for the beginning of the Seleucid Empire, gives themselves either one or two names, which is Antiochus or Seleucus. Those weren't the actual names. It's like the royal family will take on in England. You know, they will often take on specific names if they don't have a royal name. Same thing is kind of going on here. They weren't constantly calling their kids Antiochus or Seleucus as much as taking that name on almost as title when they become the empire. But the...
Like popes also.
Like any sort of official thing, it tends to come with a name also rather than a title. But the Hanukkah story in many ways begins in 192 BCE, when Antiochus III decides to conquer Greece. This is the only time Greeks really enter the story as Greeks. And basically, the Romans don't like this. Rome has relatively recently come onto the scene as an incredible superpower. It's kind of taking the world by storm with its just brilliant military organization. And to cut a long story short, the Romans go to war against the Seleucids to help the Greeks. I think the Seleucids have Hannibal on their side. It's like there's broader kind of politics going on here, and the Romans win. And then in 188 BCE, you have the Treaty of Apamea, between Rome and the Seleucid Empire. And it basically lays out the rules Antiochus III must obey to basically not have Rome come and kill him and everyone he knows. There are two kind of key parts to this treaty. One is not so interesting, but nonetheless, he has to give up all his war elephants. You may know kind of Hanukkah stories about war elephants. So the Seleucids were known for their war elephants. It was kind of their thing, but what's interesting is they had to give them all up at this point. So it's unclear if they would have actually had any war elephants when fighting the Maccabim. But nonetheless, that's kind of just a side point, that all of these stories about war elephants in the Hanukkah story, that's because that's what the Seleucids were kind of known for. That was their main military thing. More importantly, is that the son of the king must go to be a hostage in Rome. And thus the son of one of the sons of Antiochus III, a boy or man called Mithridates, again, butchering all the names, but sounds good enough, Mithridates goes to Rome to be a hostage. I'm gonna guess it's a very common name. Okay. Still. he's going to get a name change soon, and then okay. We won't refer to him as Mithridates anymore. Not long after Antiochus III dies, Seleucus IV ascends the throne. Due to the Treaty of Apamea, remember, the son of a king must be the hostage, and so Mithridates returns home. Seleucus IV sends one of his sons to be hostage instead. And then this is where things start getting really cool. This is where, really, the TV show kicks off. Seleucus IV is assassinated. Unclear why. Unclear who did it, but you're going to guess in a second who arranges the killing. And with his son and heir in Rome as hostage, Mithridates seizes the throne. He makes himself co-regent along with one of Seleucus IV's other sons, who's then himself mysteriously killed. Actually, it's not a mystery. Mithridates has him killed. So now in 175 BCE, Mithridates becomes Seleucid king, and this is where we need a dramatic thunderclap, because he becomes Antiochus IV. The Antiochus who we actually know as Antiochus, this is the guy who's the big bad in the Hanukkah story. What's very, very important to note at this point is that Antiochus IV, who I'm just going to refer to as Antiochus until we have to switch to another Antiochus, Antiochus IV has had many formative years in Rome. So he actually has, and again, this is where calling them the Greeks is maybe even more of a misnomer, because if Antiochus is anything, he is Roman. He brings in and institutes a lot of Roman-influenced ideas into his kingdom. He basically sets up a republic in the same way Rome had a republic. So basically all the citizens, people can voluntarily accept citizenship, and they basically become kind of offshoots of Antioch. And basically these people can choose to embrace the citizenship of the Seleucid Empire. You'll see his name. His official title was Antiochus IV Epiphanes. But he actually gains a nickname at this point, which is Antiochus IV Epimenes, which is a hilarious play on words, because it means the mad one. Because everyone thought he was really strange. There are stories of him basically walking around in a toga and asking the public to elect him, which again is a very Roman thing, but not a very Seleucid thing. He goes to public baths. He sets up gladiatorial shows in Antioch, builds a temple to Jupiter, starts establishing parts of his army in very, very Roman ways. He does all of these things. He basically, it's kind of like an Anglophile in America, like suddenly starts like acting very English. So too, he suddenly starts acting very Roman. Again, people appreciate some things, like gladiator shows are always fun. Who doesn't like one of those? But fundamentally, he's known as the crazy king. The strange king, because of all of these new innovations, all of these Roman things he's starting to do, but that's actually going to be very, very crucial in explaining something that happens pretty soon in history. But there are a couple of things to also bear in mind. The first is, he's very nice to Jews at this point. He has nothing against the Jews. He is the king of an empire. He offers them, he extends them citizenship. They're allowed to voluntarily accept citizenship and thus become more Hellenistic, adapt, you know, themselves to more and more parts of, you know, Greek-ish culture. You don't have to. He doesn't force anyone to do it. Again, he's actually trying to play nice with everyone. That's what a good emperor does of his empire. That's what you do. You play nice with anyone. The second thing to realize is that this divide between kind of Jews who are religious and Jews who are Hellenists as black and white is not a good divide. If you think of, and I've pointed this out before, if you look at, say, early members of Chazal who have names like Antigonos, which is a very Greek name, it's very clear and obvious that there's not this black and white divide. You have Jews who are both religious and still embracing the Hellenism. And so it's much better to think of kind of, you know, without playing too anachronistic, but honestly, 21st century American Jewry works really well as the analogy of, you have this whole spectrum of Jews. And on one end, you have your Hasidim, who reject absolutely everything of outside culture. And then the spectrum continues and you have many people who start embracing modern culture who nonetheless consider themselves religious And then the spectrum continues, and you have people who are more swayed by modern culture than the religion, and then you have kind of on the other end people who are, you know, totally embracing culture and not particularly interested in the religion. That's basically what we have here, and indeed, the Jews who are at the most kind of religious end of the spectrum are called Hasidim. They are called the pious ones, and this is a very, very important and influential group in the story. So what we have here are we have the Hasidim. We have the Hellenist Jews, who are, again, a whole spectrum of varying levels of religiosity. And then we obviously have the Seleucids, who themselves are, you know, living in the region. And this creates a tension. And this tension directly impacts the high priesthood. You'll see one of the other things that gets a lot on the kind of the cast of characters is who becomes the high priest, because it turns out it changes almost as much as who is the Seleucid king. But we start with Chonio. Chonio, or Ananias III, as he is referred to because he's the third of his name, and he is from a long line of Kohanim Gedolim. He's the Kohen Gadol at this point. And for all intents and purposes, he seems to be very much a Hasid, very much a, you know, kind of your classic, think of your classic stereotypical from Jew in this time period. And that's basically what he looks like. He's kind of, you know, I'm sure he's a complex figure. He was a complex figure in real life. But for our purposes, he's very much a pretty black and white figure. He's very much your classic picture the Kohen Gadol. That's what Chonio is. But don't really picture him for too long, because he's not the Kohen Gadol for any of this story, because he has his brother. And his brother is a Hellenist. And his brother has, in fact, changed his name. And his brother would have been born as Yehoshua, or as often happened in Bayit Sheni, where the hey of Yehoshua gets very easily dropped and it becomes Yeshua. And so Yeshua, his brother, decides to Hellenize his name. Fun fact, the Anglicization, if that's a word, of the name Yeshua is Jesus. It was a very popular name in Bayit Sheni, but the Hellenized version of Yeshua is Jason. I had great fun for the past week frustrating one of my colleagues at MIMO, who's also the rabbi of Kadima, Rabbi Jason Strauss, by pointing out that his name is Jesus. He's not appreciating it, but that's only making me double down, and he probably won't appreciate me saying that publicly. But so Jason comes along, and he's the brother of Chonio, and he decides he wants to be the high priest. So basically he approaches Antiochus, and he offers Antiochus first more revenue, because honestly, that's what he cares about the most. The Beit HaMikdash was obviously a major source of taxing the people. And he offers him more revenue, and he'll also support the further Hellenization of Yerushalayim. He will be, for Yerushalayim, kind of its main, because remember, the high priesthood is a political office as much as anything else. And he will kind of, you know, really emphasize and underscore the Hellenization of Yerushalayim, and basically create a lot of areas that are no longer affected by Jewish law. Because classically, if we think of Yerushalayim, obviously large swaths of it are in control of Jewish law. He's going to start helping the creation of lots and lots and lots of different things that will be exempt from Jewish law and instead follow kind of the Seleucid way of life instead. Obviously, Antiochus says yes. Chonio is deposed, he flees, and there's no desire whatsoever for Antiochus to kill him or anything. He leaves to a sacred place, whatever exactly that means, but Chonio will come back soon. But he leaves, and his brother Jason takes control. So now we already have a second high priest, Jason. At this time, in kind of broader political events, Antiochus learns that Ptolemy of Egypt is planning on waging war on his kingdom. And so he heads to the border, which obviously means passing through the land of Israel, and he engages in defensive maneuvers, and on his way back stops in Yerushalayim, where he is welcomed gloriously by Jason and all the other Hellenists, all of the people who have accepted upon themselves the citizenship of Antioch, absolutely love and are so excited to greet Antiochus. Again, really important just to emphasize, he's well liked by a lot of people. A lot of people appreciate this guy, want this guy to be in charge, and are very happy when Antiochus rocks up to town and give him, you know, just a wonderful welcome. But a major turning point happens in 172 BCE, which is only 3 years into Antiochus's reign, when another Hellenist Jew, Menelaus, offers even more money for the high priesthood, because this is, again, a TV show. It's going to make an amazing TV show. When you've already been willing to remove one Kohen Gadol at the promise of many, it turns out you'll always be willing to do that again for someone else who can offer even more money. So Menelaus does that. He clearly wants the grandeur of the high priesthood. It's obviously one of the most important, if not the most important, you know, political office in the land. But there's a couple of problems. He's not a Kohen. So this obviously upsets a lot of people. But it also, if Jason was, remember, Chonio was clearly the representative of the religious community. Jason is a Hellenist Jew, but still from, you know, good priestly stock. So even if he's a Hellenist, he's, you know, at least maybe, you know, represents still the religious people, still cares about the religious people's, you know, ideas too. Menelaus, he's not a Kohen. He's a, you know, he is, again, on our spectrum, he is further down the Hellenist spectrum than anyone else up until now. And that obviously creates tension within the religious community. Meanwhile, the Hellenist community, the people most loyal to Antiochus and his project, are now the most happy because they now have the guy in control of in the most important political office in the country is now a full-fledged Hellenist who doesn't care about kind of the religious side of things. That obviously is a bit of a tinderbox. A few things happen. First, obviously, Jason's not happy, and that's gonna have an impact. But also, Menelaus can't actually afford what he promised Antiochus. So what he ends up doing instead is raiding the Beit HaMikdash. And basically, there's a middle guy, and I didn't bother putting his name on the sheet, and I didn't bother even remembering his name. But there's a guy who's kind of like, Antiochus obviously isn't himself receiving the money. There's a middle guy, there's a guy in charge who's like in charge of collecting the money for the land of Israel, so Menelaus starts bribing him. This leads to riots. Plundering the Beit HaMikdash is a surefire way to drop in your popularity, and obviously the Hasidim start rioting, people are very unhappy, Chonio emerges from his sacred place to lambast Menelaus. And so what actually happens is the royal minister who Menelaus has been bribing has Chonio assassinated. However, then this royal minister himself is executed by Antiochus for assassinating the previous high priest. Because again, Antiochus at this point is still, he doesn't care about what, you know, the kind of the Hasidim side of the Jewish people thinks, but he doesn't want to start, he doesn't condone the murdering of former high priests. He cares most about his many. He cares next most about how the people who are most loyal to him, you know, are doing in the country. But that doesn't mean to say he's okay with, you know, Chonio being assassinated by his royal minister. So he actually does have his royal minister brought back and executed. Which shows again, Antiochus is still a complex figure. He's still trying to be a decent ruler. But then we get the turning point. And again, we're still pre the Hanukkah story, but we're getting closer and closer to the actual kind of Hanukkah story that's roughly referenced in Al-Hanisim. And the truth is, it's a very strange turning point. And in around, between 170 and 169 BCE, Antiochus invades Egypt. And he's very, very good at it. He overruns the entire thing up to Alexandria. And this leads, though, to a rumor. A rumor is spread that Antiochus has been killed in battle. And so, hearing that rumor, Jason, remember him, he arrives with his band of followers and attempts to capture Jerusalem. Upon seeing a band of other Hellenists arriving in Jerusalem, the Hasidim also start attacking and rioting. So you basically have three different groups all attacking and trying to kill each other. Menelaus and the kind of the, I'm going to use the term, the purest Hellenists. It's a terrible term, but keeps things simple. You have Jason and his band, who are like the pretty much Hellenists. And then you have the Hasidim, who do not like Hellenists, and they don't appreciate either of these two groups trying to control their country. And they basically, huge riots. Antiochus is not dead. And he does not appreciate people trying to kill his pick for the high priest. He does not appreciate all these people trying to attack what are for him his most loyal subjects, and so he punishes the city and plunders the Beit HaMikdash. Plundering the Beit HaMikdash is very simply a psychological tactic, because every single country had their temples, and basically if you can go in and effortlessly destroy, you know, a religion's temple, you're basically showing I am more powerful than your god. And so at this point, his plundering of the temple is retribution for what he has seen as, you know, riots against his people. A year later, 168 BCE, he again invades, he doesn't like Egypt, by the way, if this hasn't been clear. He's taken it personally when they try to invade him, and so he decides to invade them instead. However, Rome says no. Everything Antiochus, not only is Rome, you know, a superpower, not only has he signed a treaty with Rome that basically prevents him from undertaking, or his father signed it, but non-defensive acts of aggression. The Seleucids are not allowed to do on pain of Rome coming at them. And also, Antiochus wants to ingratiate himself to Rome. He grew up in Rome. He likes Rome. He wants to be respected by Rome. He wants Rome to see him as a good, you know, ruler of his own kingdom. And so when Rome says, no, don't invade Egypt, he doesn't bother invading Egypt. But it means that, you know, whenever you're heading on a trip to Egypt, that means you're passing through the land of Israel, which means things happening in the land of Israel are kind of coming more to your attention than if you're not around that area. And the mere fact that he's constantly heading to Egypt means he's constantly going to be interacting with, or at least those closest to him, are interacting with Menelaus and their band. And basically, after having heard, you know, repeated complaints from the Hellenists, about what the Hasidim are trying to do and about all the trouble that's going on and everything that's happening, Antiochus finally decides he has to do something. And so he sends a punitive expedition into the land of Israel. Lots of Hasidim are massacred. Punitive taxes are imposed. Certain privileges are now revoked from everyone. And you have basically an occupying force. Troops arrive to keep the peace. Troops arrive to protect the citizens of the Seleucid kingdom, but obviously at the expense of everyone else. And this takes us to, for us, our most relevant, accurate date. There's dates earlier where we can really zone in on kind of like day and date, but for our purposes I've been ignoring it until now. And in Nisan, or April, 167 BCE, Antiochus declares the Jews must stop observing their religion and instead observe a, quote, purified Judaism. The idea is that they must remove and they cannot worship, they cannot partake in all the parts of their religion that have turned them into rebels. And so basically he brings in basically consultants who will educate the people of how to observe this now polytheistic cult. The truth is it's not really observed. Even the Hellenists, even the really strong Hellenists are kind of like, this would cross a line to like really stop worshipping God and start worshipping a polytheistic cult. You know, that is drawing a line that maybe, you know, is a bit too far. Obviously, some Jews, you know, do accept this opportunity, but, you know, you can imagine again on our imaginary spectrum, a good chunk of the spectrum, not just the Hasidim, don't want to do this. However, on the 15th of Kislev that year, which is December 6th, those going to be, I'm guessing, Julian dates, but the 15th of Kislev, or December the 6th, Antiochus places an idol in the temple to enforce his religion, and this religion is going to include specific sacrifices, sacred prostitution, violations of the laws of ritual purity, and at this point, it is properly enforced on the Jewish people. 15th of Kislev, 167, the religious persecution begins. It is now illegal to worship Judaism. This is a very accurate part of the story. Like, the idea that this wicked king Antiochus actually forced people to not observe Judaism, actually, it's a thing. Part of the question people always ask is, why? How did this guy, who kind of wanted to be nice, and kind of wanted to do things, and yeah, we get it. what, you know, his citizens, the people he cares the most about, are the ones suffering at the hands of the Hasidim. He sees the Hasidim as the bad guys in this story, and the Hellenists as the good guys in the story. The flip of what I'm sure Yair is learning right now in Maimo's ECC. If Antiochus were telling the story, the roles would be reversed. But why is his ultimate decision to ban religion? So the author of the commentary to the Anchor Bible makes a really interesting suggestion. I think it's a really cool suggestion. I'm not sure how many scholars agree with him, but he basically says, because we have to remember that Antiochus is kind of very Roman, and this is what Rome did. And there is plenty of evidence of how Rome would quash rebellions was by forcing a new religion or philosophy upon the people. Romans tended to think that, you know, if you, and this kind of makes a lot of sense. People are most fueled by their kind of ideology and those kinds of ideas that are reinforced. So if you want to stop them from doing that, you make it illegal for them to have those ideological positions. Why are the Hasidim rising up against the Hellenists? Because they think the Torah is being violated. So what do you do? Well, if you stop them from, you know, following the Torah, if you make it illegal for them to even, you know, observe halacha, you can relatively quickly stamp out those roots of rebellion from people, and instead, if you force people to observe a different religion, it assumes that, you know, people will just take one god for another, or in this case, many gods in the place of one, and kind of be happy. It assumes that ultimately all that people want is something to worship and sacrifices to do, and who cares which one it is and which one it isn't, but obviously for the Hasidim, that's not going to carry muster. They are very specific in what they believe, and they obviously aren't too happy when this religious persecution begins. It's still, you know, up until now, it is way too simple to say Antiochus is an evil guy. I think at this point it's fair to say, yeah, he ceases to be, even if his rationale and motivations are complex, at this point I think we would all agree the forced, you know, the persecution of people for worshipping their religion is kind of one of those things that makes you onto the list of bad guys in history, and is banning people, you know, a pain of death from worshipping their religion, forcing them to do something else instead. Obviously, when you think of some of the things that took place in the Beit HaMikdash, they cut to the very core of everything the Beit HaMikdash isn't. So, like, you know, sacred prostitution, which was something that was common in a lot of other religions, not in the Beit HaMikdash, despite what Dan Brown tries to claim in one of his dumb books. Sacred prostitution was not part of, you know, the Beit HaMikdash, kind of violating the laws of ritual purity, which is kind of a big deal around the Beit HaMikdash. You force people to violate it. All these sorts of things. This is full-on religious persecution, and this is where the Hanukkah story begins. Don't worry, by the way, we're going to kind of go through everything a lot quicker. I find more interesting kind of the run-up to the Hanukkah story than the Hanukkah story. But at this point, you can finally look on your sheet at the people under the list of Maccabees. Because at this point, entering the story is Matityahu. But before we get there, it's worth exploring their name. There are three different names they go by. The most famous is Maccabees, and it's the name of the book we're going to be talking about, you know, the next 2 weeks, and the purpose why we're here today learning all of this story. Also, the Hashmonaim, or the Hasmoneans, is the term generally favored by Chazal, and also obviously in Al-Hanisim, and also the descendants, the Bnei Yehoyariv, who was, you know, one of the Kohanim, listed in Divrei Hayamim, which kind of, again, the Maccabees, it's important to remember, are Kohanim. They are not the Kohanim of the high priesthood at this point in the story, spoiler. But, spoiler alert, they will be by the end of it. But at this point, they are not. But they are, nonetheless, they are the descendants of Yehoyariv. In the books of Maccabees, they don't really get a grand name. They are connected to Yehoyariv in Divrei Hayamim, who is one of the descendants of Aharon, when in Divrei Hayamim it just gives basically the long line of descendants of Aharon and how they broke up into their various divisions among the Kohanim. Hashmonai, or Hasmonean, is not mentioned in the book of Maccabees. Josephus, who is a descendant of the Hashmonaim, and actually a very reliable describer of kind of a lot of these kinds of things, even though he lived afterwards, we'll talk about this another time, but he's very good at describing kind of the events. He uses the term Hashmonaim. Remember, what does Hashmonaim mean? So we're living in a world without surnames. So as you kind of look even at like the Seleucid kings, they all have these kinds of superlatives at the ends of their names, because basically that's how you tell them apart, because I doubt they walked around introducing themselves as Antiochus III, Antiochus IV. They were Antiochus, but you give them a kind of a superlative at the end of their name, and that's how you distinguish them. So Matityahu was, you know, would have been known as Matityahu ben someone else. That is an incredibly common name. So he gets some sort of, you know, term at the end of his name, which functions as his kind of surname. And that is Chashmonai'i. People have argued that both referring to them as Bnei Yehoyariv and also Chashmonai'i actually has pejorative connotations. The Yerushalmi has this whole interesting thing on what Yehoyariv means, because it can be interpreted as, you know, Yehoyariv is like God contends with the rebels, is not part of that meaning, but like God contends with. It can mean a positive, like God is with, God contends on behalf of, or alternatively, he's kind of against them. He doesn't like them. Given that Chazal did not like the Chashmonaim, they prefer this latter. But again, people have suggested that Chashmonai is a pejorative, which is also why the Book of Maccabees never actually uses it. If it was a positive term, it would use it. But it doesn't. It just completely avoids referring to them like that. Only by the time of Josephus is he using it, and by then it probably had dropped out of memory as to what it actually... If it did originally mean something pejorative, by the time of Josephus, no one knows that it means anything pejorative, so he's happy to use it. But at the time, some people have argued it has some sort of negative connotation. Maccabees also never used. It's used to refer to Yehuda, this was probably the one thing I should have looked up and forgot to, but I think that classic idea that means the hammer is basically actually a rough, good, you know, translation. He was kind of this mighty military guy, so he was known as Maccabee, despite the fact that the people who preserved the Book of Maccabees gave it the name the Book of Maccabees. Maccabees is not used to refer to a group. They are kind of known by their first names. They are referred to by Chazal as the Chashmonaim. I'm probably going to use the term Maccabim or Maccabees just because it's the easiest and the simplest. But the book itself, despite being called it, doesn't actually use the term to describe anyone other than Yehuda. So at this point, we now have the war. And there's now actually four groups of people. Before we had the Hasidim, we had the Hellenist Jews, and we had the Seleucids, add to that a fourth group, the Maccabim. These now enter as a distinct group within the people because they are the ones who wage a guerrilla war. Matityahu starts a guerrilla war against both the Seleucids and the Hellenist Jews. He does not distinguish between them, and he kills anyone who is, you know, part of the people he is against. A lot of religious Jews, a lot of the Hasidim, do not support Matityahu at these early stages. Part of the reason is because they believe that God does not permit violent rebellion, and indeed God will redeem them, you know, through a miracle. One of the undercurrents of this historical era are a large number of prophecies that predict an end to suffering, that predict, you know, some sort of, if not complete messianic, redemption, nonetheless, some sort of salvation will come from God, and obviously what happens in the story repeatedly is they never come about. But you have these Hasidim who are refusing to engage in the rebellion. On Shabbat, it goes to the extent that on Shabbat they don't think it's permitted to take up weapons in self-defense, and so when the royal troops arrive on Shabbat to absolutely massacre them, it's a massacre. And this kind of leads Matityahu to sway many to his side, arguing that God demands that they actually must defend themselves. At some point between 165 and 164, literally not even a year after the war starts, Matityahu dies, and his son Yehuda takes control. Yehuda is by all accounts really, really good at military things, because they start to wage many successful campaigns. Obviously, Antiochus, by the way, is not on the scene. He's not living in Yerushalayim. He's living in Antioch. He's living in his capital. In charge of Yerushalayim is Philip, who's on the sheet. He's the royal commander of Yerushalayim. He's the person in charge of kind of, you know, ruling Yerushalayim in Antiochus' stead. And Philip asks Antiochus for help. However, Antiochus has much bigger problems because in another part of his kingdom, on his eastern front in Persia, they're not paying taxes. So Antiochus at this point goes off. He exits stage right and basically doesn't appear again. He goes off. He takes half his army and he goes off to wage war in Persia. I have a friend of mine, a very good friend of mine, who studied classics in Oxford. And he once, years ago, I remember him once characterizing the Hanukkah story as on like the Seleucid side of things. It's like, that was like this tiny kingdom. They rebelled. It wasn't worth it. They had bigger things to deal with. And that's basically Antiochus is just like, I'm taking half the army. I'm going after the Persians. I'm going to plunder them. I'm going to loot them. I'm going to collect the tax they owe me and do all these other things on top of it. And he places two people in charge instead. He places his son, who's also called Antiochus, Antiochus the Fifth. He will soon be. But Antiochus is a child, and so Lysias is his regent. He's the co-regent of the kingdom, of now half the kingdom, and he's also the ward of Antiochus. Lysias receives the other half of the army and is tasked with protecting the western side of the empire. So Antiochus the Fourth does not care about what's happening in the land of Israel. Lysias, on the other hand, this is now his job. He undertakes really, really careful preparations to go and start attacking the Maccabim, but he suffers heavy losses. Menelaus and the other Hellenist Jews at this point realize things are not going well. And so they beg Lysias to come to some sort of agreement. Let's negotiate a ceasefire on all sides, because basically Menelaus realizes at some point he will end up dead if the war continues, because he is public enemy number one. He will be caught in the middle because, you know, Lysias probably does still care about him because he's a citizen of the Seleucid Empire, but ultimately someone's gonna kill men, whether it's a Chassid, whether it's a Maccabee. The Hellenists are now caught in the middle of this war they don't want, and so they beg for a ceasefire. Lysias decides he will pass it on to Antiochus the Fifth, who's now the regent. He will decide. So on March 12th in the year 164, two letters are sent to the Jews. We're going to have to talk about this another time in more detail. One is from the Romans, and the Romans seem to support the Jews in their plight here, and it seems to basically be a nudge, nudge, wink, wink, that like, leave them be. This is not something. Remember, Rome basically decides what everyone else does, and Rome is, for whatever reason, deciding to not let this go on anymore. And the other letter that's sent is Antiochus himself. Antiochus the Fifth, he offers to end the ban on religion if they pack up, go home by March 27th. So a couple of weeks later, basically everyone has a chance to gather up their stuff, end the rebellion, and this will, you know, everyone will kind of stop and you can go back to worshipping Judaism as you want under the Seleucid Empire. So Megillat Ta'anit records the 28th of Adar, which corresponds to March 25th, 160, in the year 164 BCE, as the end of persecution. It is a holiday from the perspective of Megillat Ta'anit. This is where the persecution ends. It's only about 3 years long, if that, not even. I mean, obviously, if you were living during the time, that's a long time to be persecuted for. But from kind of again, when we think of the Hanukkah story, of however many years and decades and maybe centuries it crosses, the actual story itself, 3 years, not even. However, the Book of Maccabees doesn't even record this date, because the Maccabees themselves don't accept the ceasefire. In the run-up to the Yamim Noram, the high holidays, pious Jews wait for prophesied miracles to appear, to happen. They don't, and so the Hasidim take matters into their own hands, and they take control of the Beit HaMikdash. They take it back from Menelaus, they purify it in various ways. I'm not getting into this thing, what I'm about to say, because honestly, I find it so confusing, but basically, they are running the wrong calendar at this point. If you think about, you know, the Jewish calendar requires spotting the moon, it requires intercalation. There's a whole complex set of things that need to be done to always basically make sure that a lunar calendar lines up with the solar one. We spend an awful amount, I mean, we don't anymore, but back in the day, an awful amount of energy was expended. And a lot of, you know, religious polemics were issued over people who miscalculated the dates of Yom Kippur. So you can imagine in a time of war, these things tend to fall off track. So, on the 25th of Kislev, which should be a date that's familiar, which is actually, if you calculate the calendar correctly, the 25th of Tishrei, which is October 16th in 164 BCE, they celebrate a rededication of a new Mizbeach, a new altar, and other things in the Beit HaMikdash. And they actually, at this point, celebrate Sukkot, because they've not been able to celebrate Sukkot until this point, and it's basically the time of Sukkot anyway, when they kind of realize it. But obviously, a dedication of the Mizbeach is a Chanukat HaMizbeach. It's a Chanukah. They rededicate the Beit HaMikdash on the 25th of Kislev at this point, and they decide they will make it a festival to always be celebrated. A Chanukat HaMizbeach will be commemorated on the 25th of Kislev. And amusingly, at this point, I'd written into my notes before I'd finished the shiur, quote, I don't want to go into this in too much detail, but simply put, and then there's still at least another like two and a bit pages to go. So the post-Chanukah story is crazy. Every single person who rises to any sort of political office is killed by someone else, who everyone at this point is usurping every single person. And honestly, at a certain point, I'm like, this is post the Hanukkah story. When it comes to the Book of Maccabees, it has less relevance, and where relevant, we can touch on it in coming weeks, but kind of the highlights of the post Hanukkah story. Because remember, the Maccabim never accepted the ceasefire. They are still at war. The big thing is Antiochus IV dies while fighting his war in Persia, and so Antiochus V becomes the king of the Seleucid Empire. Because the Maccabees haven't ended the war, Antiochus V besieges Jerusalem, but also people argue in an attempt to kind of curry favor with the Hasidim, he deposes Menelaus at this point. He sends him to be executed, and he places in his stead Eliakim or Alkimus. Eliakim I'm going to use because it's just a much easier name to say. Eliakim becomes the high priest. And while this is liked by some Hasidim appreciate that Menelaus, who's really kind of the big bad of the story, he's gone. Obviously, the Maccabim themselves don't like this. They don't like anything. They are the extremists of this story, and they have a very black and white view, and Eliakim is not for them.
Is he a
Kohen? So I was about to say no. And this is part of the problem.
They are somewhat
complicated, but Eliakim is not a Kohen. And what actually happens, side point, but nonetheless, in this grand TV show, the spin-off show that would happen afterwards, is what happens actually to Chonio's descendants, who've clearly been kind of patiently waiting in the wings for like everything to settle down, and they are the natural high priesthood, and they kind of are waiting to become once again the high priests. They see Eliakim take the throne, and they leave. They leave to Egypt, and they actually build a second Beit HaMikdash. They build their own Beit HaMikdash at Leontopolis, which was a very real thing, but a shiur for another time, but just very cool. It's one of those things that you forget, and then you remember that there was a time when there was another Beit HaMikdash in another country, but it was the people who ran it were, ironically, the actual Kohanim of the Beit HaMikdash. They were like, this is ridiculous, we're going to make our own, and it's going to be better, and it's actually going to be... So you have this weird thing where you have the actual Beit HaMikdash being run by people not of the Kohen Gadol line, and you have a not actual Beit HaMikdash being run by people who are actually from the Kohen Gadol line, which is maybe the most Jewish thing that has ever happened in the whole of history of shuls. No, this is even more. This is the ultimate breakaway minion. But Antiochus V does make peace with the Jews, but again, it's unclear whether the Maccabim themselves are actually involved in this. They don't seem to be happy at all with making peace. Demetrius, who you'll look on your sheet. So by the way, Demetrius is the son of Seleucus. So he's been in Rome all this time. And he finally escapes from Rome as hostage. And he murders Lysias and Antiochus V. You see, Antiochus V has a very short-lived reign. Antiochus was only 11 when he was killed. And so Democritus takes his rightful place as king. So again, if you look, you have Antiochus, his son Seleucus, and then Demetrius is the son of Seleucus. The two Antiochuses are themselves usurpers, but Demetrius gets to the throne by himself being a usurper. Confusing, but again. Fast forward to 160 BCE, because we're just going to skip all of this. The Maccabees, they've still not stopped fighting. But at this point, they are on their last legs. They are severely weakened, and the final blow is that Yehuda is killed. And this deflates the already slim Maccabees, and they cease their resistance. So basically, at this point in 160 BCE, this is the end of the revolt. 4 years after the revolt had ended, the revolt actually ends. The true, you know, this is probably real in like almost all wars, but the war actually ends many years later after the war officially ended. But the war at this point kind of peters out as the Maccabim just basically, the few of them left are just like, they give up and they go home. Eliakim dies in 159 BCE. And at this point, the Seleucids have basically learned their lesson, because for 7 years, no one is Kohen Gadol. They don't want to pick one because at this point they've realized every time they pick a Kohen Gadol, lots and lots of people die. And they've realized at this point it's just not worth it. The people are crazy and they're very picky about who their Kohen Gadol is. And so you have this 7 year gap. All in the reign of Demetritus where no Kohen Gadol is picked. In the year 152 BCE at Sukkot, we do get a new high priest, and that is Yonatan. Yonatan has an asterisk next to him because he's the same Yonatan who's the Maccabee. So he is the leader of the Maccabim after Yehuda has died, and he is also the high priest. He decides he's not had enough of playing politics and war, and so he sides with Alexander Balas, who's trying to take the throne from Demetritus. And so in 150, Alexander becomes king, and so Yonatan is now not just leader of the Maccabees and not just high priest, but Yonatan is very good at playing politics, and so for siding with the guy who became king, he is appointed governor of Judea. And a very long story short, because again, at this point, it's too much. Even when Alexander Balas is himself deposed from his throne and Demetritus II, Yonatan remains loyal to basically whoever is king, and he remains the governor. At this point, there's just a bajillion more Seleucid kings in a very short period of time. Yonatan is actually captured, and so his brother Shimon takes over his various roles. The final thing for us that really opens us into the Book of Maccabees that we'll start talking about next week is the period from 103 BCE to 76 BCE, and where Alexander Yanai, who's a descendant of the Maccabim, ascends to both being the Kohen Gadol and the throne of Yehuda. He is now not the governor, but the king. It has become its own independent kingdom, ruled by a king who is also a high priest. He is a descendant of the Maccabees, and he got to that throne through a tremendous amount of political savviness on behalf of him and his ancestors, and also a lot of bloodshed. And Alexander Yanai's ascension to the throne is what kicks off the writings of the Book of Maccabees. Because the Book of Maccabees, the first Book of Maccabees and the second Book of Maccabees, have very, very different perspectives on Alexander Yanai as king, and thus very, very different perspectives on the story of Hanukkah. Everything I've said until now, I've basically tried to keep it as purely, it's facts. This is what happened. You can't escape, obviously, giving any sort of opinion. But ultimately, you know, we've had rebellion, we've had ceasefires, we've had people refusing to see a ceasefire, but what the books of Maccabees are about to do is see all of these events I've described through a religious lens, but also through somewhat of a political lens, and through a lens that sees the good guys of the Hanukkah story, and being very different. I mean, everyone agrees Antiochus is the bad guy, but who they think is the good guy and who they think are the less good guys is going to be very much in up for debate. As we will see next week, the first book of Maccabees basically exists entirely to prove the legitimacy of Alexander Yanai as king. And the second book of Maccabees, which came later, wants to do the exact opposite. And so they both, and this is an important point to make now, hopefully I'll remember to make it also in the coming weeks, they are both really, really good at the history. Like, they get the history. It's not like mainly, it's not like conveniently forgetting information or, you know, just passing over large swaths of the story, which kind of often happens with kind of grand retellings of history. They're actually incredibly accurate at recording most of the history. It's just the way they frame it, the narratives they add, the spin they put on it is really what makes this so fascinating. And obviously what we'll talk about in the final week is the fact that we don't care about the Book of Maccabees, but we're going to talk about the end once we've cared about it for a bit. But basically the entirety of the Book of Maccabees can only be appreciated and only understood with an awareness of the history that took place and with an awareness of kind of the successive Seleucid kings who entered the fray, with Antiochus IV deciding to, you know, get way too involved in who was in control of the Jews, which led to rebellions, which led to drastic, awful, horrific measures of quashing that rebellion, which actually only led to a far more organized and tactical rebellion, and which itself leads to a tremendous amount of different military powers existing in the region for the Maccabim to eventually ascend to both the throne and the high priesthood, despite, in the case of 2nd Maccabees and maybe Chazal, not really supposed to be doing so, or in the case of 1st Maccabees, actually following the example of basically every single biblical hero you can shake a stick at. And that's really what we'll be begin with next week, looking at the first book of Maccabees as it tries to explain and justify and show how everything the Maccabim did was indeed God's will, and they were really only, you know, they were the ultimate exemplars of religious Jewry. And then when we look at 2nd Maccabees, we'll see that maybe they can be characterized slightly differently.